Side 3, Down Below Station by C.J. Cherry, continuing on page 75. Will you walk back with me? He asked, meaning to the human camp. I'd like to talk with you. She was tempted, for this meant favor, and then she sadly thought of duty and pulled away, folded her arms, dejected at the loss of love. I sit, she said, with Bennett. Make ye spirit look at the sky, she said, showing the spirit stick, explaining a thing the Hysa did not explain. Look at he home. Come tomorrow, he said. I need to talk to the Hysa. She tilted back her head, looked at him in startlement. Few humans called them what they were. It was strange to hear it. Bring others? All the high ones, if they will come. We need Hysa up above, good hands, good work. We need trade down below, place for more men. She extended her hand toward the hills and the open plain, which went on forever. There is place. But the high ones would have to say. She laughed. Say spirit things. I, Saturn, give this to Constantine, man. All ours. I give, you take. All trade, much good things, all happy. Come tomorrow, he said, and walked away, a tall, strange figure in the slanting rain. Saturn Tam Utsapatan sat down on her heels with the rain beating upon her bowed back and pouring over her body, and regarded the grave with the rain making pocked puddles above it. She waited. Eventually others came, less accustomed to men. Dalut Hosme was one such, who did not share her optimism of them, but even he had loved Bennett. They were men and men. This much the Hysa had learned. She leaned against Dalut Hosme, sun shining through clouds, in the dark evening of their long watch, and by this gesture pleased him. He had begun laying gifts before her mat in this winter season, hoping for spring. They want Hysa up above, she said. I want to see the up above. I want this. She had always wanted it, from the time that she had heard Bennett talk of it. From this place came Constantine's, and Lucas's, but she dismissed that thought. She reckoned it as bright and full of gifts and good things as all the ships which came down from it, bringing them goods and good ideas. Bennett had told them of a great metal place holding out arms to the sun to drink his power, where ships vaster than they had ever imagined came and went like giants. All things flowed to this place and from it, and Bennett had gone away now, making a time in her life under the sun. It was a manner of pilgrimage, this journey she desired to mark this time, like going to the images of the plain, like the sleep night in the shadow of the images. They had given human images for the up above, too, to watch there. It was fit to call it pilgrimage. And the time regarded Bennett, who came from that journey. Why do you tell me? Dalut Hosme asked. My spring will be there, on up above. He nestled closer. She could feel his heat. His arm went about her. I will go, he said. It was cruel. But the desire was on her for her first traveling, and his was on him for her would grow as gray winter passed and they began to think toward spring, toward warm winds and the breaking of the clouds. And Bennett, cold in the ground, would have laughed his strange human laughter and bidden them be happy. So always the Hysa wandered, of springs and the nesting. Part 4. Pell, Sector Blue 5, 528-52. It was frozen dinner again. Neither of them had gotten in till late, numb with the stresses of the day. More refugees, more chaos. Damon ate, looked up finally realizing his self-absorbed silence, found Aline sunk in one of her own, a habit lately between them. He was disturbed to think of that, and reached across the table to lay his hand on hers, which rested beside her plate. Her hand turned, curled up to weave with his. She looked as tired as he. She had been working 2 long hours, more than today. It was a remedy of sorts, not to think. She never spoke of Estelle. She did not speak much at all. Perhaps, he thought, she was so much at work there was little to say. "I saw Tally today," he said hoarsely, seeking to fill the silence to distract her, however grim the topic. He seemed quiet. No pain. No pain at all. Her hand tightened. "Then you did right by him after all, didn't you?" "I don't know. I don't think there is a way to know." "He asked." "He asked," he echoed. "You did all you could to be right. That's all you can do." "I love you." She smiled. Her lips trembled until they could no longer hold the smile. "Aline?" She drew back her hand. "Do you think we're going to hold, pal?" "Are you afraid not?" "I'm afraid you don't believe it." "What kind of reasoning is that? Things you won't discuss with me." "Don't give me riddles. I'm not good at them. I never was." "I want a child. I'm not on the treatment now. I think you still are." Heat rose to his face. For half a heartbeat, he thought of lying. "I am. I didn't think it was time to discuss it. Not yet." She pressed her lips tightly together, distraught. "I don't know what you want," he said. "I don't know. If Aline Quinn wants a baby, all right. Ask. It's all right. Anything is. But I'd hoped it would be for reasons I'd know." "I don't know what you're talking about." "You've done a lot of thinking. I've watched you. But you haven't done any of it aloud. What do you want? What do I do? Get you pregnant and let you go? I'd help you if I knew how. What do I say?" "I don't want to fight. I don't want to fight. I told you what I want." "Why?" She shrugged. "I don't want to wait anymore." Her brow furrowed. For the first time in days, he had the feeling of contact with her eyes, of Aline as she was, of something gentle. "You care," she said. "I see that. Sometimes I know I don't hear all you say." "On ship, it's my business, having a child or not. Ship family is closer in some things and further apart in others. But you with your own family, I understand that. I respect it. Your home, too, it's yours." She managed the faintest of smiles, an offering, perhaps. "So what do you say to it?" Offices of station planning were giving out dire warnings, advice otherwise, pleadings otherwise. It was not only the establishment of Q, there was the war getting nearer. All rules applied to Constantine's first. He simply nodded. "So we're through waiting." It was like a shadow lifting. Estelle's ghost fled the place, the small apartment they had drawn in Blue 5, which was smaller, into which their furnishings did not fit, where everything was out of order. It was all at once home, the hall with the dishes stowed in the clothing lockers, and the living room, which was bedroom by night, with boxes lashed in the corner, downer wicker work, with what should have gone into the hall lockers. They lay in the bed that was the daytime couch, and she talked, lying in his arms for the first time in weeks, talked. Late into the night, a flow of memories she had never shared with him in all their being together. He tried to reckon what she had lost in Estelle, her ship, she still called it that. Brotherhood, kinship, merchant or morals, the stationer proverb ran, but he could not see Aline among the others like them, rowdy merchanters off ship for a dockside binge and a sleepover with anyone willing. Could never believe that. "Believe it," she said, her breath stirring against his shoulder. "That's the way we live. What do you want instead? Inbreeding? There were my cousins on that ship." "You were different," he insisted. He remembered her as he had first seen her, in his office on a matter involving a cousin's troubles, always quieter than the others. A conversation, a re-meeting, another, a second voyage, and Pell again. She had never gone bar-haunting with her cousins, had not made the merchant her hangouts, had come to him, had spent those days on station with him, failed to board again. Merchanters rarely married. Aline had. "No," she said, "you were different." "You'd take anyone's baby?" The thought troubled him. Some things he had never asked Aline because he thought he knew, and Aline had never talked that way. He began belatedly to revise all he thought he knew, to be hurt and to fight that. She was Aline, That quantity he still believed in, trusted. "Where else could we get them?" she asked, making strange, clear sense. "We love them, do you think not? They belong to the whole ship. Only now there aren't any." She could talk of that suddenly. He felt the tension ebb, a sigh against him. "They're all gone." "You called Elt Klen your father, Tia James your mother. Was it that way?" "He was. She knew." And a moment later, "She left the station to go with him. Not many will." She had never asked him to. That thought had never clearly occurred to him. Ask a Constantine to leave Pell. He asked himself if he would have, and felt a deep unease. "I would have," he insisted. "I might have." "It would be hard," he admitted aloud. "It was hard for you." She nodded, a movement against his arm. "Are you sorry, Aline?" A small shake of her head. "It's late to talk about things like this," he said. "I wish we had. I wish we'd known enough to talk to each other. So many things we didn't know." "It bother you?" He hugged her against him, kissed her through a veil of hair, brushed it aside. He thought for a moment of saying no, decided then to say nothing. "You've seen, pal. You realize I've never set foot on a ship bigger than a shuttle? Never been out from this station? Some things I don't know how to look at, or even how to imagine the question. You understand me?" "Some things I don't know how to ask you either." "What would you ask for?" "I just did." "I don't know how to say yes or no. Aline, I don't know if I could have left Pell. I love you, but I don't know that I could have done that after so short a time. And that bothers me, that bothers me. If it's something in me that it never occurred to me, that I spent all my planning trying to think how to make you happy on Pell. Easier for me to stay a time than for a Constantine to uproot himself from Pell. Pausing's easy, we do it all the time. Only losing Estelle I never planned. Like what's out there you never planned. You've answered me." "How did I answer you?" "By what it is that bothers you." That puzzled him. "We do it all the time." That frightened him. But she talked more, lying against him, about more than things, deep feelings, the way childhood was for a merchanter. The first time she had set foot on a station, aged 12, and frightened by rude stationers who assumed any merchanter was fair game. How a cousin had died on Mariner years back, knifed in a stationer quarrel, not even comprehending a stationer's jealousy that had killed him. And an incredible thing, that in the loss of her ship, Aline's pride had suffered. Pride. The idea set him back, so that for some time he lay staring at the dark ceiling, thinking about it. The name was diminished. A possession like the ship. Someone had diminished it, and too anonymously to give her an enemy to get it back from. For a moment he thought of Mallory, the hard arrogance of an elite breed, the aristocracy of privilege, sealed worlds and a law unto itself, where no one had property and everyone had it, the ship and all who belonged to it. Merchanters who would spit in a dockmaster's eye made grumbling retreat when a Mallory or a Quinn ordered it. She felt grief at losing Estelle. That had to be, but shame, too, that she had not been there when it mattered. That Pell had set her in the dockside offices where she could use that reputation the Quinns had. But now there was nothing at her back, nothing but the reputation she had not been there to pay for. A dead name, a dead ship. Maybe she detected pity from other merchanters. That would be bitterest of all. One thing she had asked of him. He had cheated her of it without discussing it, without seeing. "The first child," he murmured, turning his head on the pillow to look at her, "goes by Quen. You hear me, Aline? Pell has Constantine's enough. My father may sulk, but he'll understand. My mother will. I think it's important it be that way." She began to cry, as she had never cried in his presence, not without resisting it. She put her arms about him and stayed there till morning. Chapter 10. Viking Station 6552. Viking hung in view, a gleam in the light of an angry star. Mining, industry regarding metals and minerals, that was its support. Sigist Ayres watched from the vantage of the freighter's bridge, the image on the screens. And something was wrong. The bridge whispered with alarm passed from station to station, frowns on faces and troubled looks. Ayres glanced at his three companions. They had caught it too, stood uneasily, all of them trying to keep out of the way of procedures that had officers darting from this station to that to supervise. Another ship was coming in with them. Ayres knew enough to interpret that. It moved up until it was visual on the screens, and ships were not supposed to ride that close, not at this distance from station. It was big, many-vaned. "It's in our lane," Delegate Marsh said. The ship moved closer still to them, and the merchanter captain rose from his place, walked across to them. "We have trouble," he said. "We're being escorted in. I don't recognize the ship that's riding us. It's military. Frankly, I don't think we're in company space anymore." "Are you going to break and run?" Ayres asked. "No. You may order it, but we're not about to do it. You don't understand the way of things. It's wide space. Sometimes ships get surprises. Something's happened here. We've wandered into it. I'm sending a steady no-fire. We'll go in peaceably. And if we're lucky, they'll let us go again." "You think Union is here?" "There's only them and us, sir." "And our situation?" "Very uncomfortable, sir. But those are the chances you took. I won't give odds you people won't be detained. No, sir. Sorry." Marsh started to protest. Ayres put out a hand. "No. I'd suggest we go have a drink in the main room and simply wait it out. We'll talk about it." Guns made Ayres nervous. Marched by rifle-carrying juveniles across a dock much the same as Pell's, crowded into a lift with them, these two same young revolutionaries, he felt a certain shortness of breath and worried for his companions, who were still under guard near the ship's berth. All the soldiers he had seen in crossing the Viking dock were of the same stamp, green coveralls for a uniform, a sea of green on that dockside overwhelming the few civilians visible, guns everywhere. And emptiness along the upward curve of the docks beyond, deserted distances. There were not enough people. Far from the number of residents who had been at Pell, in spite of the fact that there were freighters docked all about Viking Station. Trapped, he surmised. Merchanters perhaps dealt with courteously enough. The soldiers who had boarded their own ship had been coldly courteous, but it was a good bet that ship was not going to be leaving. Not the ship that had brought them in, not any of the others out there. The lift stopped on some upper level. "Out," the young captain said, and ordered him left down the hall with a wave of the rifle barrel. The officer was no more than 18 at most. Crop-headed, male and female, they all looked the same age. They spilled out before and after him, more guards than a man of his age and physical condition warranted. The corridor leading to windowed offices ahead of them was lined with more such, rifles all fixed at a precise attitude, all 18 or thereabouts, all with close-clipped hair, all attractive. That was what urged at his attention. There was an uncommon, fresh-faced pleasantness about them, as if beauty were dead, as if there were no more distinction of the plain and the lovely. In that company, a scar, a disfigurement of any kind, would have stood out as bizarre. There was no place for the ordinary among them. Male and female, the proportions were all within a certain tolerance, all similar, though they varied in color and features, like mannequins. He remembered Norway's scarred troops and Norway's gray-haired captain, the disrepute of their equipment, the manner of them, who seemed to know no discipline, dirt, scars, age. There was no such taint on these, no such imprecision. He shuddered inwardly, felt cold gathered at his belly as he walked in among the mannequins, into offices, and further into another chamber, and before a table where sat older men and women. He was relieved to see gray hair and blemishes and overweight, deliriously relieved. "Mr. Ayres." A mannequin announced him, rifle in hand. "Company delegate." The mannequin advanced to lay his confiscated credentials on a desk in front of a central figure, a heavy-bodied woman, gray-haired. She leaped through them, lifted her head with a slight frown. "Mr. Ayres?" "Inés Anderlin," she said. "A sorry surprise for you, isn't it? But such things happen. You will now give us a company reprimand for seizing your ship? Feel free to do so. No, Citizen Andolin, it was in fact a surprise, but hardly devastating. I came to see what I might see, and I have seen plenty. And what have you seen, Citizen Ayres? Citizen Andolin. He walked forward a few paces, as far as the anxious faces and sudden movement of rifles would allow. I'm Second Secretary to the Security Council on Earth. My companions are of the Earth Company's highest levels. Our inspection of the situation has shown us disorder and a militarism in the company fleet which has passed all limit of company responsibility. We are dismayed at what we find. We disown Mazian. We do not wish to hold any territories in which the citizens have determined they wish to be otherwise governed. We are anxious to be quit of a burdensome conflict and an unprofitable venture. You know well enough that you possess this territory. The line is stretched too thin. We can't possibly enforce what residents of the beyond don't want, and in fact, why should we be interested to do so? We don't regard this meeting at this station as a disaster. We were, in fact, looking for you. There was a settling in the council, a perplexity on their faces. We are prepared, Ayres said in a loud voice, to cede formally all the disputed territories. We frankly have no further interest beyond present limits. The star-faring arm of the company is dissolved by vote of the company directorates. The sole interest we have now is to see to our orderly disengagement, our withdrawal, and the establishment of a firm border which will give us both reasonable latitude. Heads bent. The council murmured together one way and the other. Even the mannequins about the edges of the chamber seemed disturbed. We are a local authority, said Andolin at last. You'll have opportunity to carry your offers higher. Can you leash the Maziani and guarantee our security? Ayres drew in his breath. Mazian's fleet? No, if his captains are an example. You're in from Pell. Yes. And claim experience with Mazian's captains, do you? He blanked for the instant, was not accustomed to such slips. Neither was he accustomed to distances over which such comings and goings would be news. But the merchanters, he reasoned at once, would know and tell as much as he could. Withholding information was more than pointless. It was dangerous. I met, he confessed, with Norway's captain, one Mallory. Andolin's head inclined solemnly. Signy Mallory, a unique privilege. None to me. The company refuses responsibility for Norway. Disorder, mismanagement, denial of responsibility, and yet Pell is well reputed for order. I am amazed at your report. What happened there? I do not serve as your intelligence. You do, however, disown Mazian and the fleet. This is a radical step. I don't disown the safety of Pell. That's our territory. Then you are not prepared to cede all the disputed territories. By disputed territories, of course, we mean those starting with Fargon. Ah. And what is your price, Citizen Ayres? An orderly transition of power, certain agreements assuring the safeguarding of our interests. Andolin's face relaxed in laughter. You seek a treaty with us. You throw aside your own forces and seek a treaty with us. A reasonable solution to a mutual difficulty. 10 years since the last reliable report out of the beyond. Many more years than that with a fleet out of our control, refusing our direction, in a war which consumes what could be a mutually profitable trade. That is what brings us here. There was deathly silence in the room. At last, Andolin nodded, her chins doubling. Mr. Ayres, we shall wrap you in cotton wool and hand you on most gently, most gently, to Cytene. With great hope that at last someone on Earth has come to his senses. A last question, rephrased. Was Mallory alone at Pell? I can't answer. You have not yet disowned the fleet, then? I retain that option in negotiations. Andolin pursed her lips. You need not worry about giving us critical information. The merchanters will deny us nothing. Were it possible for you to restrain the Maziani from their immediate maneuvers, I would suggest you try. I'd suggest that to demonstrate the seriousness of your proposal, you at least make a token gesture toward that restraint during negotiations. We cannot control Mazian. You know that you will lose, said Andalin. In fact, that you have already lost, and you're attempting to hand us what we have already won, and get concessions for it. There's little interest for us in pursuing hostilities, win or lose. It seems to us that our original object was to make sure the stars were a viable commercial venture, and you patently are viable. You have an economy worth trading with, in a different kind of economic relationship from what we had before, saving us the entanglements with the beyond we don't want. We can agree on a route, a meeting point where your ships and ours can come and go as a matter of common right. What you do on your side doesn't interest us. Direct the development of the beyond as you like. Likewise, we will be withdrawing some jump freighters home for the commencement of that trade. If we can possibly secure some restraint on Conrad Mazian, we'll recall those ships as well. I'm being very blunt with you. The interests we pursue are so far from each other, there's no sane reason to continue hostilities. You're being recognized in all points as the legitimate government of the outer colonies. I am the negotiator and the interim ambassador if the negotiations are successful. We don't consider it defeat if the will of the majority of the colonies has supported you. The fact that you are the government in these regions is persuasive of that fact. We extend you formal recognition from the new administration which has taken charge in our own affairs, a situation I will explain further to your central authorities, and we are prepared to open trade negotiations at the same time. All military operations within our power to control will be stopped. Unfortunately, it isn't within our power to stop them, only to withdraw support and approval. I am a regional administrator, a step removed from our central directorate, but I don't think, Ambassador Ayres, that the directorate will have any hesitancy in opening discussion on these matters. At least, as a regional administrator sees things, this is the case. I extend you a cordial welcome. Haste will save lives. Haste indeed. These troops will conduct you to a safe lodging. Your companions will join you. Arrest? Absolutely the contrary. The station is newly taken and insecure as yet. We want to be sure no hazard confronts you. Cotton wool, Mr. Ambassador. Walk where you will, but with a security escort at all times, and by my earnest advice, rest. You'll be shipping out as soon as a vessel can be cleared. It's even uncertain whether you'll have a night's sleep before that departure. You agree, sir? Agreed, he said, and Andalin called the young officer over and spoke to him. The officer gestured with his hand this time. He took his leave with nods of courtesy from all the table, walked out, with a cold feeling at his back. Practicalities, he reckoned. He did not like the look of what he saw, the two alike guards, the coldness everywhere. Security Council on Earth had not seen such things when it gave its orders and laid its plans. The lack of intermediate earthward stations, since the dismantling of the Hinderstar bases, made the spread of the war logistically unlikely, but Mazian had failed to prevent it from spreading all across the beyond, had aggravated the situation, escalated hostilities to dangerous levels. The sudden prospect of having Mazian's forces reactivate those Hinderstar stations in a retrenching action behind Pell turned him sick with the mere contemplation of the possibilities. The isolationists had had their way. Too long. Now there were bitter decisions to be taken. Rapprochement to this thing called union. Agreements, borders, barriers, containment. If the line were not held, disaster loomed. The possibility of having union itself activating those abandoned earthward stations, convenient bases. There was a fleet building at Sol Station. It had to have time. Mazian was fodder for Union guns until then. Sol itself had to be in command of the next resistance. Sol, and not the headless thing the company fleet had become, refusing company orders, doing as they would. Most of all, they had to keep Pell, had to keep that one base. Ayres walked where he was led, settled into the apartment they gave him several levels down, which was excellent in comforts, and the comfort reassured him. He forced himself to sit and appear relaxed to await his companions, that they assured him would come, and they did come, finally, in a group and unnerved by their situation. Ayres thrust their escort out, closed the door, made a shifting of his eyes toward the peripheries of the compartment, silent warning against free speech. The others, Ted Marsh, Carl Bella, Ramona Diaz understood and said nothing, as he hoped they had not spoken their minds elsewhere. Someone on Viking Station, a freighter crew, was in great difficulty, he had no doubt. Supposedly merchanters were able to pass the battle lines with no worse than occasional shepherding to different ports than they had planned, or sometimes, if it was one of Mazian's ships that stopped them, confiscation of part of the cargo or a man or woman of the crew. The merchanters lived with it. And the merchanters who had brought them to Viking would survive the tension until what they had seen at Pell and here ceased to be of military value. He hoped for their sakes that this was the case. He could do nothing for them. He did not sleep well that night, and before morning of main day, as Andalin had warned him, they were roused out of bed to take ship further into Union territory. They were promised their destination was Cytene, the center of the rebel command. It was begun. There was no retreat. Chapter 11. Pell. Detention. Red Sector 62752. He was back. Josh Talley looked at the window of his room and met the face which was so often there, remembered after the vague fashion in which he remembered anything recent, that he had known this man, and that this man was part of all that had happened to him. He met the eyes this time, and feeling more of definite curiosity than he was wont, moved from his cot, walking with difficulty for the general weakness of his limbs, advanced to the window and confronted the young man at closer range. He put out his hand to the window, wishing, for others kept far from him, and he lived entirely in white limbo, where all things were suspended, where touch was not keen and tastes all bland, where words came at distance. He drifted in this whiteness, detached and isolated. "Come out," his doctors told him. "Come out whenever you feel inclined. The world is out here. You can come when you're ready." It was a womb-like safety. He grew stronger in it. Once he had lain on his cot, disinclined even to move, leaden-limbed and weary. He was much, much stronger. He could feel moved to rise and investigate this stranger. He grew brave again. For the first time he knew that he was getting well, and that made him braver still. The man behind the pane moved, reached out his hand, matched it to his on the window, and his numbed nerves tingled with excitement, expecting touch, expecting the numb sensation of another hand. The universe existed beyond a sheet of plastic, all there to touch, unfelt, insulated, cut off. He was hypnotized by this revelation. He stared into dark eyes and a lean young face of a man in a brown suit, and wondered was it he, himself, as he was outside the womb, that hands matched so perfectly, touching and not touched. But he wore white, and it was no mirror. Nor was it his face. He dimly remembered his own face, but it was a boy his memory saw, an old picture of himself. He could not recover the man. It was not a boy's hand that he reached out, not a boy's hand that reached back to him, independent of his willing it. A great deal had happened to him, and he could not put it all together, did not want to. He remembered fear. The face behind the window smiled at him, a faint, kindly smile. He gave it back, reached with his other hand to touch the face as well, barriered by cold plastic. "Come out," a voice said from the wall. He remembered that he could. He hesitated, but the stranger kept inviting him. He saw the lips move with the sound which came from elsewhere. And cautiously he moved to the door which was always, they said, open when he wanted it. It did open to him. Of a sudden he must face the universe without safety. He saw the man standing there, staring back at him, and if he touched, it would be cold plastic, and if the man should frown, there was no hiding. "Josh Talley," the young man said. "I'm Damon Constantine. Do you remember me at all?" Constantine. The name was a powerful one. It meant Pell and power. What else it had meant would not come to him, save that once they had been enemies and were no longer. It was all wiped clean, all forgiven. Josh Talley. The man knew him. He felt personally obligated to remember this Damon and could not. It embarrassed him. How are you feeling? Damon asked. That was complicated. He tried to summarize and could not. It required associating his thoughts, and his strayed in all directions at once. Do you want anything? Damon asked. Pudding, he said, with fruit. That was his favorite. He had it every meal but breakfast. They gave him what he asked for. What about books? Would you like some books? He had not been offered that. Yes, he said, brightening with the memory that he had loved books. Thank you. Do you remember me? Damon asked. Josh shook his head. I'm sorry, he said miserably. We've probably met, but you see, I don't remember things clearly. I think we must have met after I came here. It's natural you'd forget. They tell me you're doing very well. I've been here several times to see about you. I remember. Do you? When you get well, I want you to come to my apartment for a visit sometime. My wife and I would like that. He considered it, and the universe widened, doubling, multiplying itself, so that he was not sure of his footing. Do I know her, too? No, but she knows about you. I've talked to her about you. She says she wants you to come. What's her name? Eileen. Eileen Quinn. He repeated it with his lips, not to let it leave him. It was a merchanter name. He had not thought of ships. Now he did. Remembered dark and stars. He stared fixedly at Damon's face, not to lose contact with it, this point of reality in a shifting white world. He might blink and be alone again. He might wake in his room, in his bed, and not have any of this to hold on to. He clenched his mind about it with all his strength. You'll come again, he said. Even if I forget, please come and remind me. You'll remember, Damon said. But I'll come if you don't. Josh wept, which he did easily and often, the tears sliding down his face, a mere outwelling of emotion, not of grief or joy, only profound relief, a cleansing. Are you all right? Damon asked. I'm tired, he said, for his legs were weak from standing, and he knew he should go back to his bed before he became dizzy. Will you come in? I have to stay in this area, Damon said. I'll send you the books, though. He had forgotten the books already. He nodded, pleased and embarrassed at once. Go back, Damon said, releasing him. Josh turned and walked back inside. The door closed. He went to his bed, dizzier than he had thought. He must walk more, enough of lying still. If he walked, he would get well faster. Damon. Eileen. Damon. Eileen. There was a place outside which became real to him, to which for the first time he wanted to go, a place to reach for when he turned loose of this. He looked to the window. It was empty. For a terrible lonely moment he thought that he had imagined it all, that it was a part of the dream world which shaped itself in this whiteness, and that he had created it. But it had given him names. It had detail and substance independent of himself. It was real, or he was going mad. The books came. 4 cassettes to use in the player, and he held them close to his chest and rocked to and fro, smiling to himself and laughing, cross-legged on his bed, for it was true. He had touched the real outside, and it had touched him. He looked about him, and it was only a room, with walls he no longer needed. Book 2 Chapter 1, Part 1 Down below main base 9252. The skies were clear for the morning, only a few fleecy puffs overhead, and a line of them marshaling themselves across the northern horizon beyond the river. It was a long view. It usually needed a day and a half for the horizon clouds to come down to down below base, and they planned to take advantage of that break, patching the washout which had cut them off from base 4 and all the further camps down the chain. It was, they hoped, the last of the storms of winter. The buds on the trees were swelling to bursting, and the grain sprouts, crowded by flood against the crossed beam lattices in the fields, would soon want thinning and transplanting to their permanent beds. Main base would be the first to dry out, and then the bases downriver. The river was some bit lower today, so the report came in from the mill. Amelia saw the supply crawler off on its way down the muddy road downriver, and turned his back, walked the slow, well-trampled way toward higher ground, and the domes sunk in the hills, domes which had gotten to be twice as numerous as before, not to mention those that had transferred down the road. Compressors thunked along out of rhythm, the unending pulse of humanity on down below. Pumps labored, adding to the thumping, belching out the water which had seeped into the domes despite their best efforts to waterproof the floors, more pumps working down by the mill dikes and over by the fields. They would not cease until the logs in the fields stood clear. Spring. Probably the air smelled delightful to a native. Humans had little impression of it, breathing in wet hisses and stops through the masks. Emilio found the sun pleasant on his back, enjoying that much of the day. Downers skipped about, carrying out their tasks with less address than exuberance, would rather make 10 scurrying trips with a handful than one uncomfortable laden passage to anywhere. They laughed, dropped what light loads they bore to play pranks on any excuse. He was frankly surprised that they were still at work with spring coming on so in earnest. The first clear night they had kept all the camp awake with their chatter, their happy pointing at the starry heavens and talking to the stars. The first clear dawn they had waved their arms to the rising sun and shouted and cheered for the coming light. But humans had gone about with a brighter mood that day too, with the first clear sign of winter's ending. Now it was markedly warmer. The females had turned smugly alluring, and the males had turned giddy. There was a good deal of what might be downer singing from the thickets and the budding trees on the hills, trills and chatter and whistles, soft and sultry. It was not as giddy as it would get when the trees sprang into full bloom. There would come a time that the Haisa would lose all interest in work, would set off on their wanderings, females first and solitary, and the males doggedly following to places where humans did not intrude. A good number of the third season females would spend the summer getting rounder and rounder, at least as round as the wiry Haisa became, to give birth in winter, snugged away in hillside tunnels, little mites all limbs and ruddy baby fur, who would be scampering about on their own in the next spring, what little humans saw of them. He passed the Haisa games, walked up the crushed rock pathway to operations, the dome highest on the hill. His ears picked up a crunching on the rocks behind him, and he looked back to find Satin limping along in his wake, arms out for balance, bare feet on sharp stones, and her imp's face screwed up in pain from the path designed for human boots. He grinned at the imitation of his strides. She stood and grinned at him, unusually splendid in soft pelts and beads and a red rag of synthetic cloth. "Shuttle comes, Constantine man." It was so. There was a landing due on this clear day. He had promised her, despite good sense, despite axioms that world-synced pairs were unstable in the spring season, that she and her mate might work a term on station. If there was a downer who had staggered about under too heavy loads, it was Satin. She had tried desperately to impress him. "See, Constantine man, I work good." "Pack to go," he observed of her. She displayed the several small bags of no knowing what which she had hung about her person, patted them, and grinned delightedly. "I packed." And then her face went sad, and she held out her open arms. "Come love you, Constantine man, you and your friend." Wife. The Haisa had never figured out husband and wife. "Come in," he bade her, touched by such a gesture. Her eyes lit with pleasure. Downers were discouraged even from the vicinity of the operations dome. It was very rare that one was invited inside. He walked down the wooden steps, wiped his boots on the matting, held the door for her, and waited for her to adjust her own breather from about her neck before he opened the inner seal. A few working humans looked up, stared, some frowning at the presence, went back to their jobs. A number of the techs had offices in the dome, divided off by low wicker screens. The area he shared with Maliko was farthest back, where the only solid wall in the great dome afforded him and Maliko private residential space, a 10-foot section with a woven mat floor, sleeping quarters, and office at once. He opened that door beside the lockers, and Satin followed him in, staring about her as if she could not absorb the half of what she saw. Not used to roofs, he thought, imagining how great a change it was going to be for a downer suddenly shipped to station. No winds, no sun, only steel about. Poor Saturn. Well, Maliko exclaimed, looking up from the spread of charts on their bed. Love you, Saturn said, and came with absolute confidence, embraced Maliko, hugged her cheek to cheek around the obstacle of the breather. You're going away, said Maliko. Go to you home, she said. See Bennett home. She hesitated, folded hands diffidently behind her, bobbed a little, looking from one to the other of them. Love Bennett, man. See he home. Fill up eyes, he home. Make warm, warm we eyes. Sometimes downer talk made little sense. Sometimes meanings shot through the babble with astonishing clarity. Emilio gazed on her with somewhat of guilt, that for as long as they had dealt with downers, there was none of them who could manage more than a few of the chattering downer words. Bennett had been best at it. The Heisa loved gifts. He thought of one, on the shelf by the bed, a shell he had found by the riverside. He got it and gave it to her, and her dark eyes shone. She flung her arms about him. Love you, she announced. Love you too, Saturn, he told her. And he put his arms about her shoulders, walked her out through the outer offices to the lock, set her through. Beyond the plastic, she opened the outer door, took her mask off and grinned at him, waved her hand. I go work, she told him. The shuttle was due. A human worker would not have been working on the day he was leaving assignment, but Saturn headed away with a slam of the flimsy door and anxious enthusiasm, as if at this late date someone's mind could be changed. Or perhaps it was unfair to attach to her any human motives. Perhaps it was joy or gratitude. Downers understood no wages. Gifts, they said. Bennett Jason had understood them. The downers tended that grave, laid shells there, perfect ones, skins, set up the strange knobby sculptures that meant something important to them. He turned, walked back to the operations center, to his own quarters and Maliko. He took off his jacket, hung it on the peg, breather still about his neck, an ornament they all wore from the time clothing went on in the morning till it went off at night. Got the weather report from station, Maliko said. We're going to catch it again in a day or so after the next one hits us. There's a big storm brewing out to sea. He swore. So much for hopes of spring. She made a place for him among the charts on the bed, and he sat down and looked at the damages she had red-penciled. Flood areas station was able to show them, down the long chains of beads which were the camps they had established, along unpaved, hand-hacked roads. Oh, it's going to get worse, Maliko said, showing him the topographical chart. Comp projects enough rain with this one to get us flood in the blue zones again, right up to Base 2's doorstep, but most of the roadbed should be above the flood line. Emilio scowled, expelled a soft breath. We'll hope. The road was the important thing. The fields would flood for weeks more without harm except to their schedules. Local grain thrived on the water, depended on it in the initial stages of their natural cycles. The lattices kept young plants from going downriver. It was human machinery and human tempers which suffered most. Downers had the right idea, he said. Give up during the winter rains, wander off when the trees bloom, make love, nest high, and wait for the grain to ripen. Maliko grinned, still marking her charts. He sighed, unregarded, pulled over the slab of plastic which served him as a writing desk, and started making out personnel assignments, rearranging priorities with the equipment. Perhaps, he thought, perhaps if he pleaded with the downers, arranged some special gifts, they would hang on a little longer before their seasonal desertion. He regretted losing Saturn and Bluetooth. The pair of them had been of enormous help, persuading their fellows an outright argument when it came to something their Constantine man wanted very badly. But that went both ways. Saturn and Bluetooth wanted to go. They wanted something now in his power to give, and it was their time to have their way, before their spring came on them and they passed all self-control. They were dispersing old hands and trainees and queue assignees down the road to each of the new bases, trying to keep proportions which would not leave staff vulnerable to riot, trying to make the queue folk into workers, against their belief that they were being used, tried to work with morale. It was the willing ones they moved out, and the surliest main base had to keep in that one huge dome, many times enlarged and patched onto until dome was a misnomer. It spread irregularly over the next hill, a constant difficulty to them. Human workers occupied the several domes next, choice ones, comfortable ones. They were always reluctant to be transferred out to more primitive conditions at the wells or the new camps, alone with the forest and the floods and Q and strange Hysa. Communication was always the problem. They were linked by comm, but it was still lonely out there. Ideally, they wanted aircraft links, but the one flimsy aircraft they had built some years back had crashed on the landing field 2 years ago. Light aircraft and down-below storms did not agree. Hacking a landing site for shuttles, that was on the schedule, at least for Base 3. But the cutting of trees had to be worked out with the downers, and that was touchy. With the tech level they managed on-world, crawlers were still the most efficient way of getting about, patient and slow as the pace of life on down below had always been, chugging away through mud and flood to the wonderment and delight of downers. Petrol and grains, wood and winter vegetables, dried fish, an experiment in domesticating the knee-high pitsu which downers hunted. "You bad," downers had declared in the matter. "Make they warm and you camp and you eat. No good, this thing." But downers at Base 1 had become herders, and they had all learned to eat domestic meat. Lucas had ordered it, and this was one Lucas project that had worked well. Humans on down below fared well enough, equipped and fed themselves and station, even with the influx they had gotten. That was no small task. The manufactories up on station and the manufactories here on down below were working non-stop. Self-sufficiency, to duplicate every item they normally imported, to fill every quota not alone for themselves, but for the overburdened station, and to stockpile what they could. It was all falling into their laps here on down below, the excess population, the burden of station-bred people, their own and refugees, who had never set foot on a world. They could no longer depend on the trade which had once woven Viking and Mariner, Esperance and Pan-Paris and Russell's and Voyager, and others into a great circle of their own, supplying each other's needs. None of the other stations could have gone it alone. None had the living world it took, a living world and hands to manage it. There were plans on the board now, the first crews moved, to go for the on-world mining they had long delayed, duplicating materials already available in Pell System at large, just in case things got worse than anyone wanted to think. They would get massive new programs underway this summer, when downers were receptive to approach again, get it well moving in fall, when the downers hit their working season, when cool winds made them think of winter again, and they seemed never to rest, working for humans and working to carry soft mosses into their tunnels in the wooded hills. Down below was due to change. Its human population had quadrupled. He mourned it. Maliko did. They had gridded off areas already, Maliko's ever-present charts, places which no human should ever touch, the beautiful places, the sites they knew for holy, and the places vital to the cycles of Hysa and wild things alike. Ram it through council in their own generation, even this year, before the pressures mounted. Set up protections for the things which had to endure. The pressure was already with them. Scars were already on the land, the smoke of the mill, the stumps of trees, the ugly domes and fields imposed on the riverside and being hacked out all along the muddy roads. They had wanted to beautify it as they went, make gardens, camouflage roads and domes, and that chance was gone. They would not, he and Maliko were resolved together, would not let more damage happen. They loved down below, the best and the worst of it, the maddening Hysa and the violence of the storms. There was always the station for human refuge. Antiseptic corridors and soft furniture were always waiting. But Maliko thrived here as he did. They made pleasant love at night with the rain pattering away on the plastic dome, with the compressors thumping away in the dark, and down below's night creatures singing madly just outside. They enjoyed the changes the sky made hour by hour, and the sound of the wind in the grass and the forest about them, laughed at downer pranks, and ruled the whole world with power to solve everything but the weather. They missed home, missed family, and that different, wider world, but they talked otherwise, had talked even of building a dome to themselves in their spare time in years to come, when homes could be built here, a hope which had been closer a year or so ago, when the down-below establishment had been quiet and easy, before Mallory and the others had come, before Q. Now they simply figured how to survive at the level at which they were living, moved population about under guard for fear of what that population might try to do, opened new bases at the most primitive level, ill-prepared, tried to care for the land and the downers at once, and to pretend that nothing was amiss on station. He finished the assignments, walked out, and handed them to the dispatcher, Ernst, who was also accountant and comp man. They all did a multitude of jobs. He walked back again into his bedroom office, surveyed Maliko and her lap full of charts. "Want lunch?" he asked. He reckoned on going to the mill in the afternoon, hoped now for a quiet cup of coffee and first access to the microwave, which was the dome's other luxury of rank, time to sit and relax. "I'm nearly done," she said. A bell rang, three sharp pulses, disarranging the day. The shuttle was coming in early. He had assumed it for the evening slot. He shook his head. "There's still time for lunch," he said. The shuttle was down before they were done. Everyone in operations had come to the same conclusion, and the dispatcher, Ernst, directed things between bites of sandwich. It was a hard day for everyone. Emilio swallowed the last bite, drank the last of his coffee, and gathered up his jacket. Maliko was putting hers on. "Got us some more Q-types," Jim Ernst said, from the dispatch desk, and a moment later, loudly enough to carry through all the dome, 200 of them! They've got them jammed in that frigging hold like dried fish. Shuttle, what are we supposed to do with them?" The answer crackled back, garble, and a few intelligible words. Emilio shook his head in exasperation and walked over to lean above Jim Ernst. "Advise Q, Dome, they're going to have to accept some crowding until we can make some more transfers down the road." "Most of Q is home at lunch," Ernst reminded him. As policy, they avoided announcements when all of Q was gathered. They were inclined to irrational hysteria. "Do it," he told Ernst, and Ernst relayed the information. Emilio pulled the breather up and started out, Maliko close behind him. The biggest shuttle had come down, disgorging the few items of supply they had requested from station. Most of the goods flowed in the other direction, canisters of down-below product waiting in the warehouse domes to be loaded and taken up to feed Pell. The first of the passengers came down the ramp as they reached the landing circle beyond the hill, crushed-looking folk in coveralls, who had probably been frightened to death in transfer, jammed into a cargo hold in greater number than should have been, certainly in greater number than they needed on down below all at one moment. There were a few more prosperous-looking volunteers, losers in the lottery process. They walked aside. But guards off the shuttle waited with rifles to herd the queue assignees into a group. There were old people with them, and a dozen young children at least, families and fragments of families if it held to form, all such folk as did not survive well in station quarantine. Humanitarian transfer. People like this took up space and used a compressor, and by their classification could not be trusted near the lighter jobs, those tasks involving critical machinery. They had to be assigned manual labor, such of it as they could bear. And the children, at least there were none too young to work or too young to understand about wearing the breathers or how to change a breather cylinder in a hurry. "So many fragile ones," Maliko said. "What does your father think we are down here?" He shrugged. "Better than Q up above, I suppose. Easier. I hope those new compressors are in the load, and the plastic sheeting." "Bet they're not," Maliko said, dourly. There was a shrieking from over the hill toward base and the domes, downer screeches, not an uncommon thing. He looked over his shoulder and saw nothing and paid it no mind. The disembarking refugees had stopped at the sound. Staff moved them on. The shrieking kept up. That was not normal. He turned, and Maliko did. "Stay here," he said, "and keep a hand on matters." He started running up the path over the hill, dizzy at once with the breather's limitations. He crested the rise, and the domes came into sight, and there was in front of huge Q dome what had the look of a fight, a ring of downers enclosing a human disturbance, more and more Q folk boiling out of the dome. He sucked air and ran all out, and one of the downers broke from the group below, came running with all-out haste. Satin's Bluetooth, he knew the fellow by the color of him, which was uncommonly red-brown for an adult. "Lucas, man," Bluetooth hissed, falling in by him as he ran, bobbing and dancing in his anxiety. "Lucas Man's all mad." That took no translation. He knew the game when he saw the guards there. Bran Hale and crew, the field supervisors. There was a knot of shouting cue folk, and the guards had guns leveled. Hale and his men had gotten one youth away from the group, ripped his breather off so that he was choking, would stop breathing if it kept up. They held the fainting boy among them as hostage, a gun on him, holding rifles on the others, and the cue folk and the downers on the edges were screaming. "Stop that!" Emilio shouted. "Break it up!" No one regarded him, and he waded in alone, Bluetooth hanging back from him. He pushed men with rifles and had to push more than once, realizing all at once that he had no gun, that he was bare-handed and alone, and that there were no witnesses but downers and Q. They gave ground. He snatched the boy from those who held him, and the boy collapsed to the ground. He knelt down, feeling his own back naked, picked up the breather that lay there and got it over the boy's face, pressed it there. Some of the Q folk tried to close in, and one of Hale's men fired at their feet. "No more of that," Emilio shouted. He stood up, shaking in every muscle, staring at the several score Q workers outside, at others still jammed by their own numbers within the dome, at 10 armed men who had rifles leveled. He was shaking in every muscle, thinking of Riot, of Maliko just over the hill, of having them close in on him. "Back up," he yelled at Q. "Ease off," and rounded on Bran Hale, young, sullen, and insolent. "What happened here?" "Tried to escape," Hale said. "Mask fell off in the fight. Tried to get a gun." "That's a lie," the Q folk shouted in a babble of variants, and tried to drown Hale's voice. "Truth," Hale said. "They don't want more refugees in their dome. A fight started, and this troublemaker tried to bolt. We caught him." There was a chorus of protest from the Q folk. A woman in the fore was crying. Emilio looked about him, having difficulty with his own breathing. At his feet, the boy had seemed to come to, writhing and coughing. The downers clustered together, dark eyes solemn. "Bluetooth," he said. "What happened?" Bluetooth's eyes shifted to Bran Hale's man. "No more than that." "Me eyes see," said another voice. Satin strode through, braced herself with several bobs of distress. Her voice was high-pitched, brittle. "Hail, push he friend, hard with gun. Bad push she." There were shouts from Hale's side, derision. Shouts from the Q side. He yelled for quiet. It was not a lie. He knew downers and he knew Hale. It was not a lie. They took his breather? "Take," Satin said, and clamped her mouth firmly shut. Her eyes showed fear. "All right." Emilio sucked in a deep breath, looked directly at Bran Hale's hard face. "We'd better continue this discussion in my office." "We talk right here," Hale said. He had his crowd about him, his advantage. Emilio matched him stare for stare. It was all he could do, with no weapons and no force to back him. "Downer's word," Hale said, "isn't testimony. You don't insult me on any downer's word, Mr. Constantine. No, sir." He could walk away, back down. Surely operations and the regular workers could see what was going on. Maybe they had looked out from their domes and preferred not to see. Accidents could happen in this place, even to a Constantine. For a long time, the authority on down below had been John Lucas and his hand-picked men. He could walk away, maybe reach operations, call help for himself from the shuttle, if Hale let him, and it would be told for the rest of his life how Emilio Constantine handled threats. "You pack," he said softly, "and you be on that shuttle when it leaves, all of you." "On a downer bitch's word?" Hale lost his dignity, chose to shout. He could afford to. Some of the rifles had turned his way. "Get out," Emilio said. "On my word, be on that shuttle. Your tour here is over." He saw Hale's tension, the shift of eyes. Someone did move. A rifle went off, sizzled into the mud. One of the Q men had struck it down. There was a second when it looked like Riot. "Out," Emilio repeated. Suddenly the balance of power was shifted. Young workers were to the fore of Q, and their own gang boss Way. Hale shifted eyes left and right, remeasured things, finally gave a curt nod to his companions. They moved out. Emilio stood watching them in their swaggering retreat to the common barracks, even yet not believing that trouble was over. Beside him, Bluetooth let out a long hiss, and Satin made a spitting sound. His own muscles were quivering with the fight that had not happened. He heard a suff of air, the dome sagging as the rest of Q surged out, all 300 of them, breaching their lock wide open. He looked at them, alone with them. "You take those new transfers into your dome, and you take them in without bickering and without argument. We'll make new diggings. You will, and they will, quick as possible. You want them to sleep in the open? Don't you give me any nonsense about it." "Yes, sir," Wei answered after a moment. The woman who had been crying edged forward. Emilio stepped back, and she bent down to help the stricken boy, who was struggling to sit up. Mother, he reckoned. Others came and helped the boy up. There was a good deal of commotion about it. Emilio grasped the youth's arm. "Want you in for a medical," he said. "Two of you take him over to operations." They hesitated. Guards were supposed to escort them. There were no guards, he realized in that instant. He had just ordered all the security forces in main base off-world. "Go on inside," he said to the rest. "Get that dome normalized. I'll talk to you about it later." And while he had their attention, "Look around you. There's all of a world here, blast you. I'll give us help. Talk to me if there's some complaint. I'll see you get access. We're all crowded here, all of us. Come look at my quarters if you think otherwise. I'll give some of you the tour if you don't believe me. We live like this because we're building. Help us build, and it can be good here for all of us." Frightened eyes stared at him. No belief. They had come in on overcrowded, dying ships, had been in queue on station, lived here in mud and close quarters, moved about under guns. He let go his breath and his anger. "Go on," he said. "Break it up. Get about your business. Make room for those people." They moved, the boy and a couple of the young men toward operations and the rest back into their dome. The flimsy doors closed in sequence this time, walking them through, group after group, until all were gone, and the deflated dome crest began to lose some of its wrinkles as the compressor thumped away. There was a soft chattering, a bobbing of bodies. The downers were still with him. He put out his hand and touched Bluetooth. The downer touched his hand in turn, a calloused brush of flesh, bobbed several times in the residue of excitement. At his other side stood Satin, arms clenched about her, her dark eyes darker still and wide. All about him, downers with that same disturbed look. Human quarrel, violence, alien to them. Downers would strike in a moment's anger, but only to sting. He had never seen them quarrel in groups, had never seen weapons. Their knives were only tools and hunting implements. They killed only game. What did they think, he wondered. What did they imagine at such a sight, humans turning guns on each other? "We go up above," Satin said. "Yes," he agreed, "you still go. It was good, Satin, Bluetooth, all of you. It was good you came to tell me." There was a general bobbing, expressions of relief among all the Haisa, as if they had not been sure. The thought occurred to him that he had ordered Hale and his men off on that same shuttle, that human spite might still make things uncomfortable. "I'll talk to the man in charge of the ship," he told them. "You and Hale will be in different parts of the ship. No trouble for you, I promise." "Good, good, good," Satin breathed, and hugged him. He stroked her shoulder, turned and received an embrace from Bluetooth as well, patted his rougher pelt. He left them and started toward the crest of the hill, on the track to the landing site, and stopped at the sight of several figures standing there. Maliko, two others, all had rifles. He felt a sudden surge of relief to think he had had someone at his back after all. He waved his hand that it was all right, hastened toward them. Maliko came quickest, and he hugged her. Maliko's two companions caught up, two guards off the shuttle. "I'm sending some personnel up with you," he said to them. "Discharged, and I'm filing charges. I don't want them armed. I'm also sending up some downers, and I don't want the two groups near each other, not at any time." "Yes, sir." The two guards were blank of comment, objected to nothing. "You can go back," he said. "Start moving the assignees this way. It's all right." They went about their orders. Maliko kept the rifle she had borrowed of someone, stood against his side, her arm tight about him, his about her. "Hale's lot," he said. "I'm packing them all off." "That leaves us no guards." "Q wasn't the trouble. I'm calling station about this one. His stomach tightened, reaction beginning to settle on him. I guess they saw you on the ridge. Maybe that changed their minds. Station's got a crisis alert. I thought sure it was Q. Shuttle called Station Central. Better get to operations then and cancel it. He drew her about. They walked down the slope in the direction of the dome. His knees were water. I wasn't up there, she said. Where? On the ridge. By the time we arrived up there, they were just downers in Q. He swore, marveling then that he had won that bluff. We're well rid of Bran Hale, he said. They reached the trough among the hills, walked the bridge over the water hoses and up again, across to operations. Inside, the boy was submitting to the medic's attention, and a pair of techs was standing, armed with pistols, keeping a nervous watch on the Q folk who had brought him in. Emilio motioned a negative to them. They cautiously put them away, looked unhappy with the whole situation. Carefully neutral, Emilio thought. They would have gone with any winner of the quarrel out there, no help to him. He was not angry for it, only disappointed. You all right, sir? Jim Ernst asked. He nodded, stood watching, with Malika beside him. Call station, he said after a moment. Report it settled. Part 2. They nestled in together in the dark space humans had found for them in the great empty belly of the ship, a place which echoed fearfully with machinery. They had to use the breathers, first of what might be many discomforts. They tied themselves to the handholds, as humans had warned them they must, to be safe, and sat and hugged Bluetooth Dilute Hosme, hating the feel of the place and the cold and the discomfort of the breathers, and most of all fearing because they were told that they must tie themselves for safety. She had not thought of ships in terms of walls and roofs, which frightened her. Never had she imagined the flight of the ships as something so violent that they might be dashed to death, but as something free as the soaring birds, grand and delirious. She shivered with her back against the cushions humans had given them, shivered and tried to cease, felt Bluetooth shiver too. We could go back, he said, for this was not of his choosing. She said nothing, clamped her jaw against the urge to cry that yes, they should, that they should call the humans and tell them that two very small, very unhappy downers had changed their minds. Then there was the sound of the engines. She knew what that was, had heard it often, felt it now, a terror in her bones. We will see Great Sun, she said, now that it was irrevocable. We will see Bennett's home. Bluetooth held her tighter. Bennett, he repeated, a name which comforted them both. Bennett Jacent. We will see the spirit images of up above, she said. We will see the sun. There was a great weight on them, a sense of moving, of being crushed at once. His grip hurt her. She held to him no less tightly. The thought came to her that they might be crushed unnoticed by the great power which humans endured, that perhaps humans had forgotten them here in the deep dark of the ship. But no, downers came and went. Hysa survived this great force and flew, and saw all the wonders which inhabited the up above, walked where they might look down on the stars, and looked into the face of great sun, filled their eyes with good things. This waited for them. It was now the spring, and the heat had begun in her and in him, and she had chosen the journey she would make, longer than all journeys, and the high place higher than all high places, where she would spend her first spring. The pressure eased. They still held to each other, still feeling motion. It was a very far flight. They had been warned so. They must not loose themselves until a man came and told them. The Constantine had told them what to do, and they would surely be safe. Satin felt so with a faith which increased as the force grew less, and she knew that they had lived. They were on their way. They flew. She clutched the shell which Constantine had given her, the gift which marked this time for her, and about her was the red cloth which was her special treasure, the best thing, the honor that Bennett himself had given her a name. She felt the more secure for these things and for Bluetooth, for whom she felt an increasing fondness, true affection, not the springtime heat of mating. He was not the biggest and far from the handsomest, but he was clever and clear-headed. Not wholly. He dug in one of the pouches he carried, brought out a small bit of twig, on which the buds had burst, moved his breather to smell it, offered it to her. it brought with them the world, the riverside, and promises. She felt a flood of heat which turned her sweating, despite the chill. It was unnatural being so close to him and not having the freedom of the land, places to run, the restlessness which would lead her further and further into the lonely lands where only the images stood. They were traveling in a strange and different way, in a way that great sun looked down upon all the same, and so she needed to do nothing. She accepted Bluetooth's attentions, nervously at first, and then with increasing easiness, for it was right. The games they would have played on the face of the land until he was the last male determined enough to follow where she led were not needed. He was the one who had come farthest, and he was here, and it was very right. The motion of the ship changed. They held each other a moment in fear, but this man had warned them of, and they had heard that there was a time of great strangeness. They laughed and joined and ceased, giddy and delirious. They marveled at the bit of blossoming twig which floated by them in the air, which moved when they batted at it by turns. She reached carefully and plucked it from the air, and laughed again, letting it free. "This is where Sun lives," Bluetooth surmised. She thought that it must be so, imagined Sun drifting majestically through the light of his power, and themselves swimming in it, toward the up above, the metal home of humans, which held out arms for them. They joined and joined again in spasms of joy. After long and long came another change, little stresses at the bindings, very gentle, and by they began to feel heavy again. "We are coming down," Saturn thought aloud. But they stayed quiet, remembering what they had been told, that they must wait on a man to tell them it was safe. And there was a series of jolts and terrible noises, so that their arms clenched about each other, but the ground was solid under them now. The speaker overhead rang with human voices giving instructions, and none of them sounded frightened, rather as humans usually sounded, in a hurry and humorless. "I think we are all right," Bluetooth said. "We must stay still," she reminded him. "They will forget us." "They will not," she said, but she had doubts herself. So dark the place was and so desolate, just a little light where they were, above them. There was a terrible clash of metal. The door through which they had come in opened, and there was no view of hills and forest now, but of a ribbed throat-like passage which blasted cold air at them. A man came up it, dressed in brown, carrying one of the hand speakers. "Come on," he told them, and they made haste to untie themselves. Saturn stood up and found her legs shaking. She leaned on Bluetooth, and he staggered too. The man gave them gifts, silver cords to wear. "Your numbers," he said. "Always wear them." He took their names and gestured out the passage. "Come with me. We'll get you checked in." They followed down the frightening passage, out into a place like the ship belly where they had been, metal and cold, but very, very huge. Saturn stared about her, shivering. "We are in a bigger ship," she said. "This is a ship, too." And to the human, "Man, we in up above?" "This is the station," the human said. A hint of cold settled on Saturn's heart. She had hoped for sights, for the warmth of sun. She chided herself to patience, that these things would come, that it would yet be beautiful. Part 3. Pell, Blue Sector 5, 9252. The apartment was tidied, the odds and ends tucked into hampers. Damon shrugged into his jacket, straightened his collar. Elaine was still dressing, fussing at a waistline that, perhaps, bound a little. It was the second suit she had tried. She looked frustrated with this one, too. He walked up behind her and gave her a gentle hug about the middle, met her eyes in the mirror. "You look fine. So what if it shows a little?" She studied them both in the mirror, put her hand on his. "It looks more like I'm gaining weight." "You look wonderful," he said, expecting a smile. Her mirrored face stayed anxious. He lingered a moment, held her because she seemed to want that. "Is it all right?" he asked. She had perhaps overdone, had gone out of her way to look right, had gotten special items from commissary, was nervous about the whole evening, he thought. Therefore the effort, therefore the fretting about small things. "Does having Tally come here bother you?" Her fingers traced his slowly. "I don't think it does." but I'm not sure I know what to say to him. I've never entertained a unioner. He dropped his arms, looked her in the eyes when she turned about. The exhausting preparations, all the anxiety to please. It was not enthusiasm. He had feared so. You suggested it. I asked, were you sure? Aline, if you felt in the least awkward in it. He's ridden your conscience for over 3 months. Forget my qualms. I'm curious. Shouldn't I be? He suspected things. A more than willingness to accommodate him, that balance sheet Aline kept. Gratitude, maybe, or her way of trying to tell him she cared. He remembered the long evenings, Aline brooding on her side of the table, he on his, her burden Estelle, and his, the lives he handled. He had talked about Tally a certain night. He ended up listening to her instead, and when the chance came, such gestures were like Aline. He could not remember bringing her another problem but that, so she took it, tried to solve it, however hard it was. Unioner. He had no way of knowing what she felt under those circumstances. He had thought he knew. "Don't look that way," she said. "I'm curious," I said. "But it's the social situation. What do you say? Talk over old times? Have we possibly met before, Mr. Tally? Exchanged fire, maybe? Or maybe we talk over family. How's yours, Mr. Tally? Or maybe we talk about hospital. How have you enjoyed your stay on Pell, Mr. Tally?" "Aline, you asked. I wish I'd known how you felt about it." "How do you feel about it, honestly?" "Awkward," he confessed, leaned against the counter. "But, Aline, if you want to know what I feel about it, I'm uneasy, just uneasy. He's coming here, and he'll be here for us to entertain, and frankly, I don't know what we're going to do with him." She turned to the mirror and tugged at the waistline. "All of which is what I think. I'm hoping he'll be at ease and we'll all have a pleasant evening." He could see it otherwise, long silences. "I've got to go get him," he said. "He'll be waiting." And then, with a happier thought, "Why don't we go up to the concourse? Never mind the things here. It might make things easier all round, neither of us having to play host." Her eyes lightened. "Meet you there? I'll get a table. There's nothing that can't go in the freeze. Do it." He kissed her on the ear, all that was available, and gave her a pat, headed out in haste to make up the time. The security desk sent a call back for Tally, and he was quick in coming down the hall. A new suit, everything new. Damon met him and held out his hand. Tally's face took on a different smile as he took it, quickly faded. "You're already checked out," Damon told him, and gathered up a small plastic wallet from the desk. Gave it to him. "When you check in again, this makes it all automatic. Those are your ID papers and your credit card, and a chit with your comp number. You memorize the comp number and destroy the chit." Tally looked at the papers inside, visibly moved. "I'm discharged?" Evidently, staff had not gotten around to telling him. His hands trembled, slender fingers shaking in their course over the fine-printed words. He stared at them, taking time to absorb the matter, until Damon touched his sleeve, drew him from the desk and down the corridor. "You look well," Damon said. "It will sell." Their images reflected back from the transport doors ahead, dark and light, his own solid aquiline darkness and Tally's pallor like illusions. Of a sudden he thought of Aline, felt the least insecurity in Tally's presence, the comparison in which he felt all his fault, not alone the look of him, but the look from inside that stared at him guiltless, which had always been guiltless. "What do I say to him?" he echoed Aline's ugly questions. "Sorry? Sorry I never got around to reading your folder? Sorry I executed you? We were pressed for time? Forgive me. Usually we do better." He opened the door, and Tally met his eyes in passing through. No accusations, no bitterness. "He doesn't remember. Can't." "Your pass," Damon said as they walked toward the lift, "is what's called white tag. See the colored circles by the door there? There's a white one, too. Your card is a key. So's your comp number. If you see a white circle, you have access by card or number. The computer will accept it. Don't try anything where there's no white. You'll have alarm sounding and security running in a hurry. You know such systems, don't you?
I understand.
You recall your comp skills?
A few spaces of silence.
Arms comp is specialized, but I recall some theory.
Much of it?
If I sat in front of a board, probably I would remember.
Do you remember me?
They had reached the lift. Damon punched the buttons for private call, privilege of his security clearance. He wanted no crowd. He turned, met Tally's too open gaze. Normal adults flinched, moved the eyes, glanced this way and that, focused on one and the other detail. Tally's stare lacked such movements, like a madman's, or a child's, or a graven god's.
I remember you asking that before, Tally said. You're one of the Constantines. You own Pell, don't you?
Not own, but we've been here a long time.
I haven't, have I?
An undertone of worry.
What is it, Damon wondered with a crawling of his own skin, what is it to know bits of your mind are gone? How can anything make sense?
We met when you came here. You ought to know, I'm the one who agreed to the adjustment. Legal Affairs Office. I signed the commitment papers.
There was then a little flinching. The car arrived. Damon put his hand inside to hold the door.
You gave me the papers, Tally said. He stepped inside and Damon followed, let the door close. The car started moving to the green he had coded.
You kept coming to see me. You were the one who was there so often, weren't you?
Damon shrugged. I didn't want what happened. I didn't think it was right. You understand that?
Do you want something of me?
Willingness was implicit in the tone, at least acquiescence, in all things anyway.
Damon returned the stare.
Forgiveness, maybe, he said, cynical.
That's easy.
Is it?
That's why you came? That's why you came to see me? Why you asked me to come with you now?
What did you suppose?
The wide field stare clouded a bit, seemed to focus.
I have no way to know. It's kind of you to come.
Did you think it might not be kind?
I don't know how much memory I have. I know there are gaps. I could have known you before. I could remember things that aren't so. It's all the same. You did nothing to me, did you?
I could have stopped it.
I asked for adjustment, didn't I? I thought that I asked.
You asked, yes.
Then I remember something right. Or they told me. I don't know. Shall I go on with you? Or is that all you wanted?
You'd rather not go?
End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.